This is The Conversation. I'm Michael Shaw. Welcome to the show. It's episode number 105. Liat Yosefor is our guest today. That is mine and co-host Jen Collins coming up in a moment. And before that, the most recent episode, that was Sarah Thornton was the guest. She is the art world ethnographer, 7 days in the art world, 33 artists and three acts. That one has about the average numbers of downloads and whatnot, and was surprised. It still can get a second win, but if you haven't heard that one yet, go listen and do let us know what you think of it. I'm curious. I haven't gotten a lot of feedback on that one. Maybe because nothing that controversial was said, you know. But I know you have some opinions about it, so do let us know what they are. The website for the show is theconversationpod.com, and you can email the show, theconversationartpodcast@gmail.com. There's still time for a second wind. Did I say that before? Yeah. So our guest, Liat Yosefor, mine and Jen Collins, is an abstract painter, Los Angeles abstract painter, but she is going to say some things that wherever you are, you will get some value from, and she has surprisingly interesting things to say about the whole abstraction explosion, if you will. And yeah, stay tuned for that. It's good stuff. Again, the website, theconversationpod.com. I have some more words for you in the back end, but I will let us get to that conversation now. Thank you for being here, and I will talk to you a little bit later. This is The Conversation, and I am joined once again by Jen Collins.
Hi.
And if we're lucky, we'll be joined by her brother, Tom Collins, a little later.
No. No.
And we are joined by Liat Yosefor.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks
long
for
time
me.
Coming.
Yeah.
long story, but we won't get into it. So we were just talking before we started that you just had a show conclude in New York.
Yes.
Was that your first big New York show?
That was my second show. My first one was in 2012.
Same place?
Same place.
How did it go?
Went very well. And then I wanted to take a little break. Can I just jump right
yeah,
into
yeah,
that?
Please. Yeah, please.
I thought, you know, I'll take 2 days off to celebrate, you know, the accomplishment of, you know, having a show. Just even having a show, I think, is an accomplishment. And I went hiking in Ojai, and now I have a sprained ankle. So
how did it happen?
I was on a beautiful hike, and I saw a beautiful horse. And I thought that it was my job to tell my partner to pay attention to this beautiful horse. So I was doing two things. I was moving forward, still walking, but turning back to tell him about the horse and something between this, like, multitasking. I just fell on a rock. And
were you on unstable ground when you were walking?
No, it was embarrassingly a simple road. But what was funny is apparently Ojai is such a small place that this was like their big rescue. We had to call 911 because I knew immediately something, it wasn't like a regular fall. And we had so many people come out for this rescue. I'm still embarrassed when I think about it. There was such a big group of people wearing like yellow outfits and there was a helicopter.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And they put you on a gurney?
So no. So somehow there's a good Samaritan who came by with a truck and we saved us their helicopter ride or anything more dramatic. I think they wanted it to be dramatic. For them, it was like, I could tell it was exciting. The rescue was very exciting for the crew. But that's it. So I have that was my vacation after show. I celebrate the show with this.
How far into your vacation did it happen?
Luckily on the last day.
Oh, good.
Yeah. The last hike where maybe I was, I don't know. Yeah. Maybe it's fine that it happened because I had my vacation. I have an extended vacation. Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting that you celebrated the show kind of after you got back, right?
Yeah.
Because isn't there the tendency when you have a big show, you know, that it finally happens and then you have this sort of big hangover, you know, the sort
right.
of the show is done, what do I do now, let down kind of?
Well, I have another show coming up soon. So it was also
not a long letdown.
Well, no, it was just, and that's not usual for me. I'm not trying to say, oh, I have so many, you know, I have now, for some reason, those two shows are close to each other. So it wasn't accurate to say a celebration. It was really a break. I just felt like I deserve a break. That's what it was. Yeah.
Well, were there any big takeaways from the show?
Yeah, I mean, some paintings were placing collections that I was very happy about, you know, instead of, I mean, anybody who has a painting of mine, that's a fantastic thing. But there's like a hierarchy to that, of course. And I know a show in New York. It's, you know, that's all I can say about that.
Well, what's having a show like in New York different from having one here?
So the first show felt like an out-of-body experience for me because I was like, what am I doing here, you know? And
why?
I just didn't expect to show in New York. And my friend, that you know, Eva Gorgieva, introduced me to the gallery, and things happened really fast for me. Everything is very relative, right?
Yeah. But,
and I just couldn't believe it that I was there. But the second show, I felt at home with the gallery and I was more comfortable with it. And what I liked about being there for an opening in New York is that, you know, there's always the fear, like, is anybody going to show up? Because I don't know many people there. It isn't my community of friends here, but it was a full house of people who apparently just attend the openings of that gallery. And also because all the other galleries in Chelsea are open, so it was really fun. I just met people that, you know, wanted to talk to me about the work, and young people.
A lot of
young, like, painting students that came up to me. It was really sweet.
Huh.
That's
yeah.
Cool.
That even some said, and I'm led to believe, that they saw my show 2 years ago or 3 years ago.
The subtext of what you're saying makes it sound like the art audience in New York is a little bit more on top of things than here, maybe?
Oh,
which would not be surprising at all, but I'm just wondering if that's your experience.
Maybe it's just for me, with this gallery, my situation. I would be careful to make big statements about New York, LA.
Okay.
For me, it's been a very
Michael
good experience.
Tries to get you to make them.
Sounds like you're defending LA a little bit to me. But
you know, I do like the community here. Like, and one thing that I missed about having my show there is that it happened to be during a month that people from LA weren't there because it was right after the Armory, so they've already traveled to New York for the Armory. They're not going back. So I didn't have any, like, close friend of mine see the show, the kind of friends that can say, this worked, this didn't work. I didn't have, like, a painter friend of mine's honest eyes on the show. I'm going off, like, you know, strangers, which tend to be, like, more complimentary. So when you have a show in L.A., at one point, even if an opening night, people will be like, congratulations, you know. At one point, somebody is going to take you out to lunch and talk to you about the show a little more, I feel. So,
so you're going to have that, you're going to get that conversation, the honest conversation about the work when you have a show, as opposed to before you have the show in the studio.
Well, that's
where it should happen, right?
That's right. But the problem, the way that I work is really manic and very last minute. And I almost never have time to share my work with others before it leaves for a show.
Wow.
The work goes out wet, like for like 4 years in a row now.
How do they pack it when it's wet?
It goes in like these travel frames. It's complicated.
Yeah, you were saying before that the movers who had to come get your work, who had to work with these very tricky stairs.
Oh, it's
that's probably yet another thing that they can complain about, right?
No, the whole thing is like they're basically moving what would be like a wax painting, because if anything touches the surface, it will leave a mark, because the paintings are very thick oil paint that takes years to really dry. And then they're moving it down the stairs of an old Hollywood building from the 1920s with stairs that are like for skinny people, you know, like really little stairs.
You're reminding me of the stairs of Amsterdam, you know, like those really thin, steep stairs. Are they steep too?
They're steep. It's really difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah. I always feel like, can I buy you guys a beer? Like, I think there's like Scooby's next door, hot dogs, anyone? And they just like, no, goodbye.
We want to get out of here.
We hope to never see you again.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, it's one thing to lower one painting, but when you have to lower downstairs like this, like 10 large paintings, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, and there was a movie that was being shot the same day.
So they had to deal with that too?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was... Yeah.
So once you get up those stairs, you have an amazing space, right?
okay, this is why I keep the space.
Yeah.
It is unusual. I get more compliments on the space in my work. People come in and they just go on and on about the space.
Right.
Like, there's some paintings to look at,
please.
It's stunning. It's just a stunning space with a patio that opens to Bordeners. Do you know that bar in Hollywood?
Heard of it.
And so, and I'm across from Musso and Frank. I'm like in this really cool part of town.
Yeah.
It's, the building is charming. The space is like tall ceilings and ton of natural light and huge, really.
You're reminding me of a conversation from, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 episodes ago. This guy was, Cole Case, I'm going to give him a shout out, was talking about these three studio visits in particular, like with a really well-known artist, a dealer, and a nonprofit person or something like that. He was saying that with these visits in particular, but you know, it happens elsewhere as well, is one of those visits where people come in and they talk about everything but the work.
But the work.
And I'm wondering, you know, because you have that experience regularly because of your space. I mean, what do you, how do you negotiate the place when you get this vibe pretty quickly? I had it recently myself where, you know, there's clearly some reticence about talking about it. Do you just sort of say, okay, I know what's happening here. I'm just going to like, I'm going to be at peace with it. Or are you tempted to say, are you going to say anything about that?
Oh, I'm completely at peace with it. Yeah. We can talk. Then we just move on to other subjects. Look, it's you win some, you lose some. I have studio visits where people write me the next day, like, I'm still thinking about the work. Like, they just take it home. And I have studio visits with people that I know I'll never see again in that context. And it's like I have to remove my ego from that. Like, my work is not for everyone, you know. And people are usually, like, if you don't internalize the rejection and you just, you know, and call it even rejection, just go, okay, we tried, right? Then you can have a really, like, fine conversation. And But I am more likely to kind of wish they leave soon only because I'm like, okay. I mean, the part of me that's like, okay, I'm not going to really get a show out of this. At least I want to have my painting day. Like, I don't want to sit here for 3 hours.
Sure.
But I've also had studio visits with people that I expected not to like the work. And they came in and, like, all of a sudden we're in, like, just talking about the work for hours. So
why did you expect them not to like it?
You know, our, like, it's a curator that is working primarily with more conceptual art. You know, I haven't seen them work with painting before. Or it really is a painter. There is a little bit of, it's very specific to do straight painting. You know, I'm not a painter who also does sculpture and video and, you know, and it's, people have to be really open to painting and also like not bring their own sort of resentment of it, you know, from the market point of view and, you know, just come in and meet you at your, in like, and see your paintings on, in their own context, you know, judge them in their own right in that way. So, that, you know, that takes a, that is not for everyone. It's, you know.
You're anticipating a big theme that's ongoing more or less on this show, which is the abstraction, you know, versus other things conversation. Because, and you sort of you mentioned in passing, which is that there is a lot of abstraction and there is a big market thing. And and obviously that's not, I'm going to presume that that's not why you started making abstraction. But how do you how do you reconcile that reality?
It's hard because the way the market is working right now and how much they love is like what we, I guess, calling now the zombie abstractionists, right?
Yeah, how do you, to what extent are you familiar with those various lame sort of terms that are big running around there?
Unfortunately, as a painter,
zombie formalism is one of them.
Yeah, which is also, I have a criticism towards that term because anything that tries to throw a bunch of artists into the same category in this kind of lazy and cynical way is a problem. At the same time, I know what they're talking about, especially when you look at, like, there's a lot of these, like, young male abstract painters that are getting a lot of attention, and the work still looks like student work sometimes, like student work, you know? And a superficial look online, since people today are, like, buying with their iPhones, might make a painting of mine look like theirs, like there's no difference, but that's where the studio visits are important. And it's about intention and practice. And I know you hate the word, but I didn't say a practice, but the practice of making work. And what you bring to the work, because you do bring yourself, and yourself, myself is not like, you know, a 26-year-old boy painter who's selling the work for $500,000. So it's all of that, you know?
Yeah, you know, the way, I think that's a really great point, because the way you're describing it, and this is simplistic, but it could very have a lot of truth to it, which is that all these young market successful abstractionists are kind of fucking it up for all the other abstractionists in a way.
Oh, I'm sure, because this will crash. And when it crashes, it will take us all down. And this is a real problem.
When you say all, do you mean abstractionists or do you mean the whole market?
Not the whole market, but I think the market for abstract painting. And I make monochromatic abstraction. So I'm like right there. If you don't know the difference, you're not going to take the time to study me. You know, there's a real danger there, right? And I'm also benefiting from the interest in this. I'm benefiting. I'm not selling in those auctions like those boys, but there's a lot more interest in my work now. So, for example, I've been invested in it for a long time, but because it's a trend now, for some reason, all of a sudden, I'm doing something that is actually aligned supposedly with the conversation, right? But what if that's, you see, it's...
I just want you to say those boys again.
I know, I'm really enjoying that.
Sorry.
No,
that was
please.
Great. The way you said it was perfect.
Yeah.
Those boys.
They're not, you know, yeah. It's case by case, too, absolutely. Because I just went to see the MoMA show, the Forever Now.
Right.
And I know there's...
What did you think of it?
So one thing I'll say is that there's so much, there's so much conversation around Oscar Murillo to be like, you know, as many people roll their eyes at the phenomenon of Oscar Murillo, but go to see the show. And I actually think he looked perfectly fine in that show, which is also something to wonder about the other artists who hold themselves so separate from that movement of those young artists. Like the fact that he looked like he belonged at that show is very interesting for me. I haven't even digested that yet. Because I walked in and I was like, you know, I think maybe a problem with that show is that things were very crowded. So in some weird way, Nicole Eisenman and Oscar Murillo all looked like part of the same thing. And maybe that's what the curator tried to do. I'm not sure, but it is case by case and specific works, because especially if we're looking at that movement of abstraction, people are making so much work. I'm making more work than I've ever made before. Like, I cannot believe how much work I'm making right now. So if you are making, like, let's say 30 paintings instead of the 5 you would normally make a year, how many of those are going to be good works? And, you know.
So you're implying that you're flooding the market a little bit?
No. I'm just saying that all of us who are dealing with abstraction right now are making a lot more work than ever.
Why?
And, there's just a little bit more demand for it.
But isn't that flooding the market in a way?
Flooding the market. Not at my level.
That's too derogatory a way of putting it, but there is another way, better way to put it maybe, is there's enough demand to be able to make as much work as ever.
Right, but... I don't think at my level it would be flooding the market. There's just, if I look at,
That's true.
Just think there's interest in this kind of work right now. I can feel it. I know this is happening right now. This might not be here next year. I know how the art world moves quickly from one thing to another.
Wanting to show up, right? Like wanting to have a seat at the table when people are talking about the kind of work you're doing, right? And not letting the boys, the young boys, take up all the room, right?
Right. There's that, but I also want to, I was painting before and I'll paint later, and I want to continue to be a part of this and not just for the moment that it's trendy. So I think it's that, and it's also what you were saying before, Michael, that there's some danger zones here with anything that's trendy for a couple of years. And I'm very aware of it, and you know, the conversation is diluted, that's for sure, thanks to that.
Particularly these people who are buying from their phones, right? I mean these are the speculators and young buyers. I mean, I haven't talked to one,
right?
You know? I mean, if any of you are a phone buyer out there, feel free to come on. But these people are sort of a nebulous but existent you know, population in the art world,
right.
you know, that, that I've been hearing about since Nicole Klagsbrunn was talking about, you know, why she closed her gallery, you know.
Right.
So
I can't imagine different... doing that. How can you buy a painting on your phone?
Oh, my
like,
goodness.
I can't even buy a
well,
shirt
you have a big
on
phone.
My phone. I have the biggest phone.
That's a great screen.
But even on an iPad, like, how do you buy a painting on an iPad?
Because they're not buying it for any other reason than to flip it in 2-3 years. They don't have to like it. They don't have to live with it. And this is where I think I'm definitely different than those guys. I mean, I benefit a little from the interest in, like, performative abstraction, blah, blah. But it's still, I believe, I'm in a completely different category. When they're buying, like, Lucian Smith, they're not buying because they think the rain paintings are genius. There's no way, you know?
Yeah. It's flip paintings.
Yeah. It's,
right.
Yeah. It's quick money. And there's a lot of money to be made right now in that market. So I wonder if, like, in some ways, yeah, I mean, painting is in trouble right now because of that. It is.
Well, speaking of the market, I'd like to ask you about your recently deceased Los Angeles gallery, Angles.
Oh.
Since you are the first person who's shown with the gallery who since they have closed,
right.
which is fairly relatively recently, what is your experience with that whole scenario?
So I left a year before they closed because I knew they're going to close. And for some other reasons, but like you just know that something is ending and there's an energy there. And I think it's hard enough for an artist to keep hoping and going to the studio every day. And I go to the studio every day. And so, and I have my own set of very dark thoughts about this whole thing and how it's going to work out. I don't need my dealer to constantly remind me that the art world has changed. It's never going to work out. Like, not for me personally, but he was so sad at the end, the owner, that it just felt like it's spiraling down. So I left, and I don't know exactly what happened that year after, but I wasn't surprised at all when they closed.
So were you actually getting sort of warnings? Or
yeah.
What kind of warnings?
I just knew, because people can't keep things to themselves, and he was starting to think about closing the gallery, so you talk to people, and people would mention this to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can say to someone a million times, keep this between us, but in the art world, it doesn't work that way. So I think he knew that you can't possibly have those conversations and expect the artist not to find out. And I personally didn't, I think he had some artists that have been working with him for years that probably felt really loyal and wanted to be there till like the last minute. I didn't have that relationship necessarily. So I left, and I felt relieved when I left. And again, it was like there's something emotional that happens when a gallery is coming to a close. And, you know, unless you're like very, very close with them and feel like some kind of a personal obligation, I don't see a reason why to stay there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's sad, right? You know, Angles, you know, they've been around forever. They did so many important shows, you know, in 20 years or more than 20 years of hard work in LA. And it's like they're gone
Close
now.
Close to 30.
Close to 30. And another thing was that there was a point when I was like telling, you know, students about Angles and how important they were. And like, they had no idea. Like, Angles was already rendered a different kind of gallery. And not necessarily where you want to show. And it's just amazing how things change so fast.
Where are your students?
This is when I was teaching at the time at the Claremont Colleges.
Okay, but no longer.
No, I've been teaching for like a lot, for a decade, everywhere. Like, name a school I taught there.
But you're taking a break at the moment?
I'm taking a break, yeah.
Got it, okay.
Yeah. Sorry, we're not including you.
No, I'm fine. I'm listening. Can we go back to those dark thoughts?
Yes.
I'm not going to let that go. So I guess in the few minutes we had to chat before we started recording, we were just talking about, like, you know, life stuff and consciously trying not to talk about anything we would want to record, right?
Right.
But even from the chat we had on the phone a couple months ago, you know, like, I'm gonna dig for things that maybe bring up the harder parts of the conversation and maybe the harder parts of your practice. I love the word practice.
I do too.
I have a therapy practice. I practice doing lots of things. So I don't have a problem with it. If we get into like artisanal, I'm going to have to leave. But, you know, so I guess I just wanted to know, like you mentioned, you said dark thoughts. So I guess I want to know what's hard about the success that you're having right now. Like you just had a big show. It wasn't your first. It went well. Right. What's the hard part?
Oh my goodness. The work itself, first of all, I'm extremely critical and have said to the wrong people before, I don't think this is good, or, you know, I think my work is not good right now. And I said this to dealers and curators, like I just can't control myself. I don't have that, like, I found out you're supposed to say, oh, it's everything's going great. But, like, there's just so much disappointment in the studio.
Mm.
So that's first of all. The second is, like, the longevity, like, knowing that you're going to be okay in 10 years, in 20 years. Because I've already learned, I've been with many galleries already. And, like, right now, yes, I have this gallery that I love in New York. And obviously we're in a good relationship. Everything changes. Everything can change tomorrow. I don't mean to be so, you know, catastrophic, but it does change very quickly in the art world. So
that's just realistic.
It's realistic. And so there's that. And also sometimes it's even deeper than that. It's like, you know, the purpose of all this.
Mm.
You know, who is my audience? What am I really doing? You know, I recently was told about an artist that I've seen before in Frankfurt, and I went back to look at her, and I may be mispronouncing, but Charlotte Posenensky, who was a German sculptor, minimalist sculptor from the 60s. And she at one point just left, even though she had success, like real success, like the kind of museum success, and pretty young, I think, like in her 40s, she left the art world and completely and went to sociology and social work and another avenue completely, and decided not just to leave the arts, but to not even attend exhibitions. Like, her disappointment from the art world was so deep, you know, that she had to just scratch, like, just...
How did you find out about her story?
So I saw a sculpture of her at MMK in Frankfurt, and I remember asking my friend. I knew immediately, you know, there's so much minimalist sculpture that sort of looks the same, and yet this one had, like, a soul. And my friend told me the story very quickly, and then I've forgotten about her. And I just had a studio visit with someone from Vienna the other day, and they reminded me of her again. And because of my ankle, because I'm at home, I've been just like reading up on her and just thinking about what brings somebody to that point where you're like, this is just not interesting anymore.
Is she still alive?
No, she died in her when she was 50-something, pretty young.
But she had left the art, not only being an artist, but the art world when she was in her 40s.
Yeah, which is a lot like the Lee Lozano story, right? So these are two women who made this very sharp sort of dropout. And not women who did it because they didn't make it. I mean, Lee Lozano's Wave series was shown at the Whitney, right, before she decided she doesn't want to work anymore.
Mm.
What did she do after?
Her conceptual piece was The Dropout, which she dropped out of the art world. That was the piece. And then she went to live back with her parents and never participated in any way after that.
Wow. I think the first artist you were talking about, to go from art to social work,
that
rings a bell for me,
yeah.
Although I never had a career, you know, but to be socially involved and to make some work in the art world and then to leave it, right? I was 33, I think. I guess part of how I see it is you're not going to get anything like a social work experience out of the art world, especially if you have to kind of fake it and pretend everything's going well. You know, like social work is founded in social justice and in like being real with people.
Right.
You know, so having to talk to people who come to your studio and pretend that the work you're showing them is your best work and you're really into it, that would be hard for me. I think I appreciate that it's hard for you. And I think the parallel for my job now is that I can't, like I work in a hospital part-time, but it's a corporation too, right? So you kind of have to follow some rules and I don't know, this is nebulous in my head, but I guess what I'm trying to say is like, I'm not good at bullshit either. you know, and I find myself really feeling fond of you for being able to say, like, it's hard to fake it. It's hard to talk about your work in a disingenuous way, you know, like, I always appreciate a little bit of anxiety in people or a little bit of like a shakiness. You know, I think many people do, but people have to pretend they don't because it's part of some game, you know, some like bravado,
swinging your dick around. Game.
Yeah. And that's just game. Like, if we could all just put our dicks away, it would be a lot safer for everyone to make the work they want to make, to talk about it the way they want to talk about it. And, you know, the parallel in my work is to take care of people the way your gut tells you to take care of them, you know, and to do social work and to do psychotherapy the way that's indicated in the relationship, as opposed to like following evidence-based practices or following some kind of dogmatic, corporate, institutionalized version of social work.
But you also get like more like a, I'm sure like an immediate, the immediacy of doing something in the world in your line of work than what we do. I think, I mean, there's just such a direct relationship. Like you finish a day of work and you know you helped someone that day. I mean, I just think it's so different.
Well, I want to go back to
right?
I
wanna, some days.
Some days, yeah.
I want to go back to, the point about feeling uncomfortable or, you know, worried.
Yeah.
Because I think another way that I see it is when you are doing well, you know, as an artist, or it can, of course, be in anything else. You know, there's only one direction to go. So it's like, when is it going to come? Whereas it also sucks when you're looking for that break, but you don't have the pressure of when is it going to come.
Right.
Because you have something, you have improvement coming. But for you, right, that's kind of what's going on, it sounds like.
Well, I didn't do well for many years. And maybe that has to do something to do with that. Because, I mean, I just can feel the difference. I used to have to, like, beg for studio visits. And now, like, I don't have, you know, it's just not that way anymore, right? At this moment, again, it's a moment. But... and also relative to many artists I know, I'm not even doing well. Everything is so... So for me, for how I was... I feel like my practice, I have to use it, was so personal for me before. You know, it was really just me and my work and like maybe like three friends who cared to come by. And it just doesn't... Yeah. And so it's not as personal. So your worries are... You know, there's a whole new set of worries. Yeah. There's a whole
How abrupt was that? Or what was the length of time of that transition from, you know, being more private and kind of off the radar or however you want to put it, to you're different now?
It was a little abrupt because it just came
like
along.
Over a couple of years.
Yeah, it came along with like this body of work that I'm doing, which is with the gray paintings. Like the work before didn't get the interest that this works. So it came along with new, basically... my new work.
So in addition to having more frequent studio visits, what does all that look like for you?
It's subtle, again, especially when we talked about this, that kind of success of those guys. It's very subtle, but for me, it's like not teaching.
That's big.
It's a big deal. For me, it's going to the studio every day and keeping deadlines, which is, you know, and like... you know, painting on towards the next deadline, even if like normally I would want several months of just thinking and like fucking around in the studio and scraping a lot of paintings, which I do. I constantly like scrape what I don't like. And now I'm like, well, if I scrape this one, I might not make this deadline. So it's turned the studio into more of a workplace.
Production.
The studio before was very personal. I was teaching and then I would come to the studio and it was like, oh, just me and my black paintings and my romantic idea of, you know, whatever it is that I was doing there, you know, because it was just me and the work. So you can kind of make up your own ideas about yourself. And now, like, I don't even know sometimes where I'm at. It's right. And this just comes with a little bit more deadline. So I really don't know how people deal with, you know, like real careers, you know, the ones who have like assistants, and I don't know how artists do that.
Well, because you can, you have a real career, no, even though you don't have assistants.
But the thing is, like, next door to me, there's an artist that has like several assistants and several museum shows a year. And it's constantly like you feel the energy coming out of the studio, you know.
Do you go hang out there ever?
No, I hear them. I hear them. I run into them. They're all very nice. But it is like you have to be on all the time.
Who is it? Do you not want to say? It's okay.
Yeah.
Well, when you say on, you mean, you know, that they're...
It's a business.
They could... Well, is it a guy or a woman?
It's a guy. And it,
so he can never say... I'm not doing well, right?
My feeling is that he can't. I mean, it's amazing what he does. I respect it so much, but I feel it's almost like running a business in some ways, and that doesn't take away from the work. And also, his work is work that you painting is very different, you know, because it's just me and the painting in my case. But once you have people who can make your work, you can fabricate things. It does by nature become a team effort. But it just sometimes feels to me like I come in, you know, with my cup of coffee and my dog to my studio so I can paint for 10 hours, you know, by myself. And, like, there's just so much commotion next door. And it's just a reminder that those careers, they have a cost. And the cost is that it's no longer your personal, you know, like this kind of private space that studios are for many artists. You know, and I think that for him, I'm sure, like, if he's, like, he has several, you know, galleries, if they want to come by, and I'm sure they have people that, it's not, okay, I'll say I know, because I see the people that come in, you know, they bring people all the time. So let's say you have to, you know, perform for these people, like, several times a week. When is your private space with the work, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no such thing.
And I think he's a smart artist. I think he will know not to let it get out of hand too much. But of course, success is very tempting, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It's very tempting to just push forward. How many people do you know, like, do the Charlotte Pozanenska and just go no more? Or, mm-hmm. you know, those are very rare cases. I actually wish somebody curated a show for...
For people like that?
For Lee Lozano and her in particular together. Because I actually think this is very much about gender, too. There's something very gendered about those decisions, but that's like
I wonder about that, right? Like if a woman is in her 40s or 50s and decides to change careers, you know, that's an interesting age to make a life change for a woman, right?
Right.
And like, I don't know how much encouragement a woman would have to do that, or does it all come from herself? You know, I mean, you'd have to ask them, right? But it's a hard time for anyone to change.
But for them, I feel like it was more like I've been in this for 20 years and I don't buy into it. Mm-hmm. And like, if you don't buy into it for 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, it's one thing. If you've already put 20 years and they're having success, the paintings are at the Whitney, they're not buying into it, mm-hmm. you know? And mm-hmm. that's I don't even have words for that. I mean, I feel like I hope like a really great curator takes this on and examines that as a, if not gender, just like, another way to think about what we're doing to our art world. This is our art world, and we've turned it into this like machine, you know.
Well, this is your chance to plant a seed. So, who would you like me to share this idea with? because I'll just open up my Rolodex.
I don't know. I have a few people that I know that might be interested in it. I think actually when you're saying it like this, I think maybe I should write them an email.
Yeah. That we're all about action here.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be really nice if I inspire that idea actually. Yeah.
But you were let me see if I understood right. You were talking about them, but you were saying you've been in it for 20 years, right? Or you're talking about them being in it for 20 years?
I was talking about them. I've been, since grad school, more like 12 years.
Oh, not that long.
Yeah, but I've been painting since I was really young. So, like, even back in Tel Aviv, I wasn't, like, in an art school. I've been drawing and painting, like, I don't know, as long as I remember myself. Yeah.
So we didn't mention that you're Israeli, but you're just as you've been in the States longer than you were in Israel, or about the same now?
No, I've been in the States. Been in the States longer. I left Israel when I was like just shy of 16. teenager.
So do you, to what extent do you identify with being Israeli at this point?
Well, you know, people identify me as being Israeli more than I...
Well, how do you, how much do you identify with your fellow Los Angeles Israelis?
In Los Angeles? Not so much. I mean, I'm not a part of any kind of Israeli community. My parents, when we came here, we didn't go to the valley where there's more Israelis. We were in Torrance, California. I think we were the only, maybe there were two families in Torrance that were Israeli, right? I identify with both still. You know, I'm definitely, it's fluid. It's not like, but I have to say, I recently talked to a curator from Israel and I brought up an Israeli artist that I really like, Yael Botana. And the curator said to me, oh yeah, that really flat didactic work made for foreigners. And oh. I was like, wow. Now I'm the foreigner apparently because I like the work. And I guess within of Israel, there's like, they see that work as like maybe, I don't know, too simplistic about Israeli politics. But I think the work is brilliant. So I've been here longer. I've studied here in art schools here. And I probably don't necessarily share that many conversations with Israelis now that I do share with Americans, you know, it's, but you know, US Israeli relationships, of course, you know, a big subject. I don't know what angle we want to get into that.
Well, I'm much more interested yeah. in Israeli cliche personality types.
Oh.
All right. Well, we're going to come back now after having, taken a little detour, related to, Liat's being Israeli and we just didn't go places that we think you need to hear. So it's full disclosure, partial disclosure, I should say. Do you have siblings?
I do. I have a younger sister here and she lives in Michigan and she's a photojournalist. And that's it for here, but you know, and I have my parents live in San Pedro over here, but the rest of the family is back home in Israel.
Do you, so you see your parents every once in a while?
A lot. I'm very yeah. close to my family. There is something about, like, I think in immigrant families, you know, you come as like a small unit and you stick together. Mm-hmm. It's shocking to people when they find out that I see my parents like once a week. Like, who does that? Yeah, it's that close.
Do you bring friends down there?
Yeah, I had before.
I love San Pedro.
It's a little bit of the end of the world, end of the 110 freeway.
Right.
You know.
Do you ever see Mike Watt paddling around in his kayak?
No, but I heard
he does that a lot.
Yeah, there's a cool history there for like punk rock. And
right.
I worked at Angels Gate Culture Center for 4 years, actually.
Oh, cool.
And so, yeah, I was part of that culture.
First Angels Gate shout out on this show.
Oh, really? I did this before grad school.
Now, where was grad school?
UC Irvine.
And did you teach there too?
Yes.
Okay.
So, like, I taught there right after graduating for, like, about 3 years. And I had some faculty there that were like, when is your thesis show? They just, you know, I just stayed there and they thought that I'm just, like, always there. They forgot that I already graduated. And, like, so it was a very... you know, close relationship to UC Irvine, and then there was like time to leave the nest.
Well, I wonder if you were an outlier being an abstract painter there.
Yeah, it was difficult, but my work at the time was, oh my gosh, we're going back to the subject. My work at the time were portraits of women who served in the Israeli army. I don't know how we're going to circle around that, but
it
was very fitting for UC Irvine at the time. I think I had support there to make that work very much. And I actually loved working with like Daniel Martinez, who's not a painter, and then working with Kevin Appel and having that combination of somebody who's, both of them looked at the work, but sometimes with Daniel, we would just start to talk about like basically the discourse that came from the work in a way, almost a separated conversation. And with Kevin, always the eyes were on the work, but both were really, really important to me.
How so? When you made the transition into abstraction, was it like a clear demarcation of going from representational to abstraction, or was it more subtle than that?
No, it was. So my last show that was figurative and sociopolitical was my show in Germany in 2010.
And there was, that's not long ago.
Yeah. So this is what I was telling you early on, that my relationship to this kind of abstraction or like this body of work is pretty new for me. But all of my, I can't even call it figurative work, all of my work that had the figure already had, you know, many of the things that I'm doing now with abstraction I already did with a figure. For example, I made monochromatic work where I, you know, there was no color value differentiation. So it was all about mark making. Even though I was describing something, I was just mark making in a monochromatic field. I mean, there was an identifiable subject, but I still didn't think of myself as a figurative painter. So it made sense for me to leave this crutch of the figure behind and just make the work that I'm making right now. So I think in one hand it was a slow, like it makes sense to me, but it seemed abrupt to other people. Because there were like these dark sociopolitical paintings where often you could talk about, you know, actually very controversial, like, you know, a subject that brought up a lot of discussion, even if you're not looking at the work, such as Israeli military, right, for example. And then this abstraction now that's outside of language. And the whole conversation about it, you know, has a lot to do with experiencing the work and being willing to do that. There's nothing easy to grab from it and take home. There's no, like, it's very hard to summarize it. It's very hard to give it, like, a linguistic home. But for me, it's like I saw it happening in my studio slowly.
Do you see working in the way that you have been working the last 5 years as somehow less didactic than, you know, when you had this reference?
I do, for me, but I do like didactic work when it's done right. So we mentioned Yael Bertana before. I love work that just goes straight to the point with a knife and just makes you like look and think and on the spot. My work now is something that if you allowed yourself to experience it, you might go home and then you might think about it the day after, and it's this kind of slow conversation. So for my work, I think this is the better place for me to be, because I was never all the way on, like, I never revealed everything anyways when I was making sociopolitical paintings. I'm not like a political artist in that way, and I wasn't able to do it well. I don't know if painting is even equipped actually to do it well. So it's almost like the painter in me won, you know, and my personality won over the fact that I wanted to make these big statements with sociopolitical painting. I will leave that to those who do better, a better job with that, basically. But like, it's important for me that I, you know, I'm not against didactic work. Yeah. Like, maybe we don't even have enough of it right now.
Well, that's kind of what I've been thinking all along, is to play devil's advocate. The market does not particularly like the didactic work.
No, they don't. Yeah. And they didn't like the 90s identity politics, and they don't like any leftover from that, or a new thought around that, you know. And there's a lot of eye rolling for anything that you know, takes you in those avenues that it's harder to be a political artist. I don't think a conceptual artist is necessarily hard, but to be both, yeah.
But by saying this, you're winning the hearts of didactic artists out there, even though you're an abstract painter. At least that's our hope.
Because it's my love. I have such a love. I mean, I just, even Charlotte that I mentioned.
Right.
You know, I don't actually love work that looks like mine, necessarily. Like, and the work that I make sometimes, I don't know, do I even love it, you know? And am I more, it's just what I need to make.
It sounds very resolved that you figured that out.
Yeah, I guess.
Just, you know, even though you still have your doubts.
No, I found that out by teaching, actually, because I found out that I wanted to lecture about, you know, somebody's work so much, and then it would be, for example, an artist who makes more didactic work, for example. and not necessarily but another abstract painter.
What did you find out? You found out by teaching a lot about work that was or is didactic that you wanted to be an artist who did not make that work?
No, that I just admire that work, that I have room for that work, that I respect that work.
Right.
And I don't have to make the work that,
right.
I can really wear those two different hats and have a deep love for that a certain kind of work and then make a different kind of work and maybe in 2 years make something totally different altogether.
So going back to what we were talking about closer to the beginning, you maybe have an uneasy relationship with your fellow sort of abstractionists, perhaps.
No.
Like you don't want to be necessarily... You don't necessarily feel smoothly comfortable in their midst.
You're right about that.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. I think I have a struggle with, I'm still struggling with painting,
That's healthy.
Okay.
I think we're going to leave it there. How is that?
Okay.
Thank you so much, Leah.
Thank you so much. I appreciate both of you. Thank you.
Thank you, Jen.
Thank you, everybody.
And...
We're out.
Thank you very much again to Liat for talking to us and being honest in a lot of different ways, which is always appreciated from the guest. As we talked about, not a lot of bullshitting going on. That's not really her thing, and that's kind of not my thing either. And I appreciate that in guests because there's a lot of spinning going on, as you know, here and elsewhere. Wanted to let you know that the Conversation Podcast is looking for an intern. If you think you know someone who might make a good fit, they just need to be into podcasts and into contemporary art, and they will learn a lot more about both through that position. Have them get in touch via theconversationpod.com. What else? Oh, if you have some questions as to what we talked about in that cutout section, which we alluded to. Well, what are you offering in exchange for that information? Because that's some pretty valuable and private stuff, I have to say. But I bet you're curious. Yeah. Well, use your imagination. Thank you very much for listening. Again, the website, theconversationpod.com, and you can support the show there financially. You can also become a fan on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. And if you haven't already, please go to The Conversation, an artist podcast on iTunes. Leave a nice review and subscribe to the show on iTunes, even if you don't really use iTunes, because an extra subscription means more people find the show. You can always unsubscribe. It really doesn't matter, just as long as you subscribe. And even if you unsubscribe, it's still good. It still counts. Thank you very much for your support, for listening, and thank you very much again. I'll talk to you soon.